Hi, this is Chris from Pleasure Mechanics, and on today's episode of Speaking of Sex, we are thrilled to be welcoming Emily Nagoski as our guest. Emily is a preeminent thinker in the field of human sexuality. She has a PhD in health behavior with a doctoral concentration in human sexuality from Indiana University and did a clinical internship at the Kinsey Institute Sexual Health Clinic. And while at Indiana University, Emily worked as an educator and docent at the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction. She's also taught graduate and undergraduate classes in human sexuality, relationships, communication, stress management, and sex education. Whew! Emily currently works as a health director at a liberal arts college and blogs at thedirtynormal.com. And her new book, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life, is now available and is a must read for anyone interested in female pleasure. This was like my favorite book I've read about sex in such a long time. So we are thrilled to have Emily on the podcast today. Emily, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for talking to me.
I'm sure we could talk for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Oh, God, yes.
Today, we're going to focus on female pleasure and orgasm. I'm curious, your website is called The Dirty Normal, and the first part of your book is really emphasizing how people are tortured by the question of, am I normal? What do you think is behind this question, and what happens when people finally start understanding that their sexuality is part of the normal range of human sexuality?
Well, it's the most common question any sex educator gets asked, right? Yes. Is some variation on the question of, am I normal? And it took me a long time to figure out what is it people are actually asking? What is it that's so essential to people about feeling normal? Because if you think about what the technical definition of normal is, it means average. And nobody really wants to be sexually average, right? You don't want to last 3 minutes in bed or whatever it is that technically counts as average. That's what people really want, is to be healthy and whole and happy and satisfied. And to a certain extent, they want to be exceptional and extraordinary, which is the opposite of normal, right? So what is it people are actually looking for? And I thought about it for a long time, and I have decided tentatively, I might change my mind about this one day, but currently what I think people mean by normal is they want to know that they belong, that their experiences are shared with other people. You probably have had the experience of like standing in line to get a coffee and a stranger approaches you to ask you questions about their sex life.
Yes.
This is not a thing that happens to people who aren't sex educators and therapists, right? And the reason a stranger would approach a stranger in a coffee shop is because we can't talk to our best friends and sometimes even our own sex partners. We don't have a way to find out if what is going on with us sexually is shared by the people who are closest to us. And we worry that if we disclose something that is not shared by them, that that means there's something wrong and broken and sick and we don't belong here in the shared human experience. So I think that's really what people are asking is, am I a human being the same as you?
Beautiful. And I think that really fits in with the definition of sexual shame as well, this idea of wanting to belong and not be cast out when we reveal our true selves. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that so many people share this experience when we're all within this same range of human sexuality. But do you think this is because of our history and our legacy of sexual repression that we really still have this message that what is normal is such a small window? And so people think that they're outside of that even when they're perfectly normal?
Yeah, I mean, for people who were born in female bodies in particular, we get socialized to believe that there's this very rigid, narrow window of what's acceptable in terms of our bodies. And almost all of that comes, you know, from patriarchy, from the general idea that women's bodies are in the public domain, they belong to men and not to themselves. And so we're taught to believe that what other people have to say about our bodies is more trustworthy and reliable than what our body has to say about itself. We're taught to trust other people's opinions about our bodies more than we trust our own body's experience.
Yeah, and on this note, you do an amazing job talking about sexual anatomy and how our understanding of our anatomy is so culturally dependent on these messages we get. So just to give us a taste, let's talk about the hymen. You say that nearly everything we learn about the hymen is wrong. What is the truth about the hymen that we should know?
I say that nearly everything is wrong because I myself, like so many people, was totally wrong about the hymen. I thought that what I learned culturally was, you know, some of that had to be true. Turns out, no. The whole thing about the hymen breaking? No. Turns out that's not true. Hymens stretch instead of breaking. And if they do break, they heal. They can bruise and they can be a source of pain, but they're one of the least likely sources of pain with intercourse, even for people who are new at having vaginal penetration. What's actually true is that the hymen may or may not be a thing that you have if you have a vagina. The hymen can be all kinds of different shapes and sizes. The hymen can stay long after you're not a virgin, by which, you know, the technical definition, having a penis in your vagina is what a virgin is. The hymen can change over your lifespan. It can go away or it can be there when you're 95 years old. Hymens just vary and it has nothing to do with having had something in your vagina.
These kinds of facts that are scattered all throughout your section on sexual anatomy, I think, can be so life-changing because how we think about our bodies really influences how we use them, how we share them with lovers, our sense of confidence. And so I think your section on anatomy is really a must-read for any woman who wants to get to know their body or any male who wants to get to know their lover's body if it's a female. I'm curious what your process of studying anatomy has been, where you're drawing your facts from. What is your process there?
My starting point for writing the chapter was my own lecture that I give. And all of my research on the hymen happened because I was in the middle of teaching my anatomy class, and a student raised their hand and said, "So Emily, what is the evolutionary origin of the hymen?" And I had, at 15 years, I had been a sex educator, and I had never even considered the question of what the evolutionary origin of the hymen might be. And that sort of took me on this quest of looking at Google Scholar and looking at all the research I could find about what the hymen actually is and what its developmental history is. And so Google Scholar is maybe my best friend. And so that's sort of where I started.
And I think this is one of your real gifts, is you translate science for the rest of us. Your book is full of what you call surprising findings about sexuality. What were some of the things that surprised you the most from recent science about sex?
Well, the hymen surprised me, I have to say. maybe not so much what was true about the hymen as the fact that I had been wrong for so long and not known. So that was amazing to me. I was surprised. So the very last chapter, this isn't necessarily about sex, but it sort of is. So we know that mindfulness meditation is helpful. Basically, it's like vegetables for your brain. It is good for you in a lot of different ways. In particular, it's good for overcoming difficulties with sexual desire and arousal and pleasure. Mindfulness meditation has been tested with a lot of different populations, and it's just the most effective thing we've got so far. So my question as I was doing the research was, what is it about mindfulness that helps people to increase their sexual pleasure and their sexual desire? And it turns out, my automatic assumption was that it was about the awareness. It was about tuning in to what's going on with your body and paying attention to the pleasurable sensations that are going on in there. And it turns out that was wrong. What actually is predictive of mindfulness's help with sexual desire, sexual arousal, and sexual pleasure is not the amount of awareness a person has, it's their non-judgment about what it is they're aware of. So can I give you a boring sciencey example? It's not a boring example, it's an exciting sciencey example.
Yes.
One of the most amazing studies that I read in the process of writing the book was a study of generalized anxiety disorder, actually. So we take a big population of people all diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, and we assess a lot of things. They assessed the kind of symptoms they had, the frequency and the intensity of those symptoms, and then they assessed the five factors of mindfulness. So two of these five factors are awareness of your internal experience, and another factor is non-judgment. So people who score low on non-judgment as a factor of mindfulness, say things like, when I notice myself having a symptom, I tell myself I shouldn't feel that way. I try not to feel that way. Whereas people who score really high on non-judgment will say things like, when I notice myself having a symptom, I just let that be true. I know that that's true now and it's not going to be soon. Or when I notice myself having a particular anxious thought, I just notice that and recognize that that's part of the common human experience, right? So it turns out, first of all, there's no relationship between frequency or intensity of symptoms and quality of life. And that by itself is wacky. Hmm. That's amazing. You would absolutely expect, right, that frequency and intensity of symptoms would be predictive of quality of life. Turns out, no. It turns out that what's predictive of quality of life is the extent to which people are able to be non-judging of their anxious thoughts and their symptoms.
And does this relate to what you call spectatoring and how it relates to being orgasmic?
So yes, spectatoring is the experience, everybody has it happen at least sometimes, some people have it happen very often, that while you're engaged in some sort of sexual behavior, your thoughts are not focused on what's happening inside you, they're focused on sort of thinking about how your breasts are moving and the fat on your stomach and the cottage cheese on the back of your thigh or whatever else, rather than thinking about the pleasurable sensations that are happening. And the way to overcome spectatoring, because it's a real interference with sexual pleasure and arousal, and particularly orgasm, is to notice that those thoughts are happening and let them go and return your attention back to the pleasurable sensations that are happening in your body right now. And that letting go process is only possible if you are really kind and gentle with yourself and don't start, because if you notice you're having these self-critical thoughts about your body and then you start beating yourself up for having the self-critical thoughts, like, is that going to make it better? Yeah, it's probably going to make it a little harder to let go of those thoughts. So your ability to be like, oh, look, there are the self-critical thoughts. Let me just let those go temporarily. I can go back to them anytime I want to. And right now I'm just going to shift my attention to the sensations inside my body. Yeah.
Hmm. So it's both that non-judgmental mindset and bringing your awareness back to sensation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Perfect. On your blog for a long time, you've been talking about the difference between spontaneous and responsive desire. And we find this concept really helps a lot of women better understand their sexuality. Can you share a bit more about this and why it is such an aha moment for so many?
Absolutely. It's, I think, one of the most important ideas in the book and probably one of the most important ideas on the blog, too. The idea that most of us get taught that the way sexual desire is supposed to work is it should be spontaneous and out of the blue. You're just sitting there at lunch and a stray sexy thought crosses your mind and you go, ah, I would really like to go get me some sex. How can I get some sex? I would like sex, right? Which is, it's absolutely how some people do experience desire. If we're going to be categorical about it, more men than women experience desire this way for more of their life. But another way to experience desire is for it not to cross your mind until you're in a sexy, pleasurable state of mind and your partner starts kissing on you and your brain goes, oh, right, sex, that's a really good idea. It's normal not to have an active desire for sex until sex is already beginning. It makes things complicated in a relationship sometimes if both people expect desire to be spontaneous and one partner experiences it as responsive, it can create tangled knots in initiation, right? So if one partner is spontaneous and one partner is responsive in their desire style, then the spontaneous partner feels like they're always doing the initiating, and the responsive desire partner needs to come up with some strategies to sometimes do some of the initiating if that's what works for the relationship. Does that make sense?
Totally. And another question I have about it that I've been trying to work with some women on is, how do you manage responsive desire while also not having sex that you don't want to be having? So in other words, you allow the foreplay to begin and you see if you get in the zone or not. And then you really have to be communicative and responsive and tell your lover what you're up for, right?
Right.
So it's like getting to know your own patterns and being open to intimacy, but not necessarily expecting the responsive desire to work every time.
Yeah, I think this is a really central, crucial, important question, because it's easy to hear about responsive desire and think that means that women don't know what they want. And what we really need to do is learn to think distinctly about pleasure, liking, versus desire, wanting. So one of the things I talk about in chapter 3 when I get really nerdy is I talk about the distinction at the neuroanatomical level between liking and wanting. Desire, we're generally conceptualizing as wanting, which is where you're moving towards something. You have a goal that you want to get to, right? That's desire. There's something missing and you want to get that thing. Liking is just pleasure. And you can have lots and lots of pleasure without necessarily an active desire to move toward more, right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the way to create a context that allows desire to emerge is to create a context that allows you to experience a lot of pleasure. And everybody's got to cross a threshold that they cross from liking into wanting. This is true for everybody, even people who have spontaneous desire. Arousal, the pleasure, comes first, and then comes the wanting. For people with spontaneous desire, they have a really low threshold where they're very sensitive to the liking and transition very readily into wanting. People with a responsive desire style have a higher threshold where they need to accumulate a whole lot more liking before they cross that threshold into wanting.
So I think this is a really important tool for people to look at and a benefit from your book. And another one is when you talked about the inhibitors and the accelerators.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a bit about how this model emerged and why you focus so heavily on it as a way of understanding sexuality?
Yes. The reason I focus so heavily on it is because when I first learned about it in, I think, 2000, I had already been a sex educator for, I think, 5 years or so, and learning about the dual control model, I felt like my whole head was being cracked open and my brain got shaken out onto the table and then reassembled back in my brain, and everything about sex made a whole new kind of sense. And it makes, once you understand, like when you hear it, you're like, how did I understand anything about human sexuality without knowing about the dual control model? Mm. What it says, basically, is that the sexual response mechanism in the central nervous system is a pairing of an accelerator, like a gas pedal that responds to sexually relevant stimuli, and the brakes that respond to all the really good reasons not to be turned on right now. And most of us are really familiar with the idea of an accelerator where you add sexually relevant stimuli. So for a lot of us, that's lingerie or a sexy story or a sex toy or a game or role play or whatever. Like, you're adding sexually relevant stuff to increase desire levels. It turns out a much stronger predictor of sexual difficulties is too much stimulation to the brake. And the brake is responding to simple things like unwanted pregnancy or STI transmission, or more complex things like relationship and trust issues or reputation, or even more complex long-term things like body image and cultural learning about sexual shame. All that stuff is hitting the brakes, and it doesn't matter how hard you hit the accelerator. If the brakes are down, you're still not going to go anywhere. And when I had this, like, I remember so clearly sitting in the Kinsey Institute clinic meeting, hearing John Bancroft talk about the dual control model, and the inspiration for it came from noticing that the way pretty much every other motivational system in the central nervous system worked was with a pairing of brakes and gas. So why wouldn't sex work the same way as every other motivational system in our central nervous system? Not only does it make perfect sense that sex would work the same way, but when you contextualize sexual response in the context of humans are mammals, mammals are a sexually reproducing species, sex for us is a much more complex thing because it's not just about reproduction. We're not deer, where the females are interested in sex about 3 weeks out of the year and never at any other time. We're these really complex mammals who can be interested in sex all year, including when we're menstruating and when we're already pregnant or breastfeeding very regularly. We can want sex all the time because sex isn't just reproductive for us, right? sex is also a profoundly social experience. It's primarily almost all the sex we have, even without contraception involved, almost all the sex we have is non-reproductive. So just from this simple idea that there's a brake and an accelerator, just like every other sexual, every other motivational system in the human brain, comes the idea basically that sex is this profoundly social, natural way that humans communicate with each other about trust and affection. I have not been able to teach, I can't even teach about consent anymore without talking about the dual control model.
And in the book, you take us through an exercise to kind of discover if us as individuals are high inhibition.
Yeah, so cis and cess are the two things, and they sound so much alike, it's hard to tell them apart. So the excitation system is the accelerator, and the inhibition system is the brake.
And you talk about how some people have high accelerators and low mm-hmm. brakes and vice versa, and then you can get to know yourself and take more control over your sexuality. Is that the idea for the individual?
Yeah, so most of us are heaped up in the middle. This is a sort of like normal bell curve distribution where most of us are right in the middle. A small number of people will find that they might have an extra sensitive or not so sensitive accelerator. People who identify as asexual actually are most likely to have a relatively insensitive accelerator. So when sexually relevant information comes into their brains, their brain doesn't activate as much. Does that make sense?
It does.
And of course, there's lots of variability across populations. And some people may find that they have an extra sensitive or not so sensitive brake. And people with more sensitive brakes are more likely to find that they experience sexual difficulties, while people with less sensitive brakes are more likely to find that they experience impulse control and sexual compulsivity.
It's really interesting. And you talk about how your sensitivities are pretty fixed over a lifetime. But then you also say, quote, when you understand how your sexual response mechanism works, you can begin to take control of your environment and your brain in order to maximize your sexual potential, even in a broken world. And when you change your environment and your brain, you can change and heal your sexual functioning. So what do you think about the idea that we can change our sexuality, we can take control of our brain and how it works in the bedroom? Like, how much agency do we have over this?
It's, you know, quantitatively, how much agency? About 80% agency, approximately, because very little of this is genetic. There's very little genetic basis to the sensitivity. I have this terrible metaphor that I don't know if this is going to work for you or not, but if you have an oven, it's the same oven you've had in your kitchen for 20 years, and you know that it has its quirks, right? The more you know about the quirks of that oven, the more control over you have over the souffle you bake. Mm-hmm. So if you can take into account that there's a hot spot and you're going to need to turn it, but if you keep the door open for too long, that's not going to be so good. So you learn, you develop a skill for making sure you can turn your souffle in a limited amount of time to keep the heat in the oven and make sure it bakes evenly. So if you have a quirky oven, all you need to do is learn how to use it. And maybe it would be convenient if you could just get a new stove, but if this is the stove you have, the oven you have, you learn to work with it.
Mm-hmm. I love food metaphors.
Okay. And I struggle with food metaphors because sex is not a drive.
And we will leave it there for part one of our Speaking of Sex interview with Emily Nagoski. Part two will come at you next week in the Speaking of Sex podcast feed, so make sure to subscribe so you don't miss it. We'll hear why sex is not a drive, Emily's take on female orgasms, and how to reprogram your brain for more sexual pleasure. Part two will be out next week. Subscribe to Speaking of Sex so you don't miss it, and come on over to pleasuremechanics.com/Nagoski. That's NAGOSKI for all of the show notes, a link to Emily's book, and part two when it is out. We will see you next week. I'm Chris from pleasuremechanics.com, wishing you a lifetime of pleasure. Cheers.